Radio Germaine.
In Madler, notions of idyllic village life, unencumbered by the vagaries of urban development, are dispelled fairly soon. The clamorous sound of gypsies, flashy placards, and flashier tourists all serve as a reminder that tourism is the mainstay of the village. At first glance, the burgeoning tourism business seems overwhelmingly promising. People work and earn, imbued with a spirit of achievement and success. The market encourages individual entrepreneurs. Nature is conserved. Tiger populations have risen. Village homes have expanded to make rooms for homestays. The rural economy has rejuvenated after a COVID-19 slump. Western and urban Indian tourists have been sensitized to the cause of conserving tigers. Madler appears to be the land of aspirations. However, a month of ethnographic research revealed the ruptures and negotiations within this promising, flourishing industry.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the second episode of Thesis Focus, the podcast in which we invite students from the Environmental Policy Program to talk about their theses. In this second episode, Finley and I are welcoming Satya.
So Satya's just written a thesis about tiger conservation, but more specifically, the human worlds that spring up around the conservation and the commodification of tigers and the spaces they occupy. It's such a fascinating topic. How did you first get interested in tiger conservation and the people who make their lives around it?
So thank you for jumping right into the human dimension of this, because that is one of the central arguments in my thesis as well, which is that that humans have always actually had interactions with nature, also mediated it and produced it and constructed it in many different ways. And how I got into this thesis was a similar story. So I have a background in making films, actually, and I was working on a film in a South Indian tiger reserve called the BRT Tiger Reserve. So I was filming in BRT, and then I got more and more interested in the politics of tiger conservation, and I decided to pursue it in my master's thesis.
And what particularly stuck out to you about Pana Tiger Reserve? What were the specific reasons that you chose that one as opposed to any of the others or the BRT?
Part of the reason was, of course, logistical. So I speak the languages Hindi and Bundeli, which is what is spoken in Panna. And there was one part of it which was logistical. But I think the state of Madhya Pradesh, which is in central India, and Panna itself, is particularly driven towards ecotourism, which I thought was really interesting. Tiger conservation literature in India has so far focused a lot on this issue of displacements. But I think greater attention needs to be paid on the neoliberalization of this conservation activity itself. And Panna made for a great case study for that. And also contextually, what's really interesting in Panna are two things. One is that the tiger population over there had plummeted to zero in 2008 due to illegal poaching. And then the state government actually undertook a rewilding project. So they brought in tigers from neighboring tiger reserves and to revive the tiger population. And the other interesting thing is that there is actually a diamond mine in the sort of protected area, which is state run. And that also shapes the Panna economy. There are a lot of people employed in it. And as a result of this, a lot of illegal diamond mines have popped up around it, which is a whole other thing, not the focus of my thesis, but yes.
Just to kind of go back in time, could you explain to us what is the history of tiger conservation in India, what's its colonial roots, and what it's become today, in order for our audience to really grasp the context?
Absolutely. So most historians would agree that the colonial rule was central to shaping how Indian forests are today. During the colonial rule, there was a lot of timber trade. There was a lot of forest plantations for wood that was more productive. And it can be said that at this large scale, it was the first time that forests were made productive. At the same time, there was a lot of game hunting of animals like tigers and leopards. And there was the criminalization of forest dwellers and Adivasis who lived in forests, indigenous communities. And right after independence from the colonial rule, the Indian state wanted to remedy these losses but actually it followed the same imperial logics of enclosing forests and displacing forest dwellers. And this led to large-scale displacements of forest dwellers all around the country over three and a half decades. And it's not stopped even now. And in recognition of these displacements and the complete uprooting, the dispossession of lives and livelihoods of forest dwellers, and after a lot of civil society mobilization in 2006, the Forest Rights Act came about, which grants the rights to access and live in forests for forest dwellers. And this is really a landmark act in forestry in India, but the implementation of the act over the last two decades has been quite inconsistent. And so what we see throughout this history is this whole practice of enclosing forests and creating protected areas and creating really boundaries around forests. And in the current regime, these enclosures then become the sites of capital accumulation. So something you can't have something like ecotourism until a forest is demarcated and has a clear boundary around it. And it becomes a way for the state to actually act and enforce that boundary itself.
Yeah, could you maybe explain what you mean by capital accumulation? Like what's happening in those forests that's commercializing those areas or that's making profit out of these areas?
Yeah, I think actually accumulation has been occurring in these forests since the colonial era. Like I said, like I talked about timber trade earlier, which was, you know, used to build ships, etc., etc. And now what we see is that something like tourism can happen very easily because forest boundaries are clearly defined. And so like these protected areas are essential to the functioning of markets like in tourism.
Okay, so that takes us up really nicely to the present day and your entry into Pana Tiger Reserve and the communities around it. Could you just describe the process of going there and carrying out your research?
Yeah, absolutely. So I did ethnographic research in the area. I was there for over a month, almost 5 weeks. And I stayed in one of the homestays in the village, which are these small, you know, village-run enterprises which provide low-cost accommodation. And living there, I got a sort of insider's view on what the tourism economy looks like, how it's shaped, and the main actors involved. And I got to interact with a range of guides, homestay owners, you know, hoteliers who were involved in tourism.
And just to kind of get a clear image for the audience, what does the village outside of Pana Reserve look like today?
So I worked in this village called Madla, which is right opposite the Madla gate of the Tiger Reserve. The Tiger Reserve is pretty big, so it has many different gates. The village is like any typical Indian village. I want to say there are village homes. The village is actually segregated along the lines of caste. So where I was staying is what is a lower caste basti or settlement where particular communities stay. And then the closer you go to the road, you have the more high caste people's homes. There are hotels and lodges dotted around this village. And the homestays, of course, are part of the village homes. And then you have, you know, you have your gypsies, which are the safari vehicles going up and down, and they're owned privately by a bunch of people. You have the park gate, which is always abuzz with tourists, except for in the off season. So, yeah.
And what proportion of the village works with the tourism industry?
It's hard to say.
Okay.
Because a lot of it is gig work. So then people like sometimes come on board, sometimes not. So
how did you manage blending in? I think that's one of the central elements of ethnography, is that you have to stay with the people in order to connect bonds, in order to understand the situation with a lot of depth and nuance. How was that for you in terms of positioning yourself in a village or in an industry, in a context that you're not from?
That's a great question. I think there were many elements which worked in my favor. Knowing the language was one big part of it. The other thing is also generally being able to build trust. I grew up in a village in central India myself, even though in a slightly different context. But what that did was it familiarized me with a lot of the social norms that exist in villages, and it kind of made my interactions around those lines a bit easier.
Could you just give an example or a couple of examples of those kind of social norms?
Just simple things like the way that, something like how you should dress, which is not offensive to people, or the codes around gender and women. And so when I could interact with them, when they were expected to do certain things or perform certain roles, knowing those sorts of details really, I think, helped me respect the place that I was in better.
And also integrate yourself better, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so when you think about your integration, were there different things that you needed to do to different groups? Were there different aspects of yourself that were more important in different contexts?
Yeah, actually, it was quite complicated because on the one hand, I was living with this family in the village, being somewhat familiar with sort of etiquette and social code. But then there's also, I've lived in urban India more recently. I'm more familiar with that landscape. I speak English. I've received a higher level of education than a lot of people in the area. And now I'm studying in France. And so all of these factors put me in a different social milieu altogether. This really helped in my interactions with a lot of the elites in the area, especially hotel owners, and they really look up to the fact that I was, studying abroad, which is very aspirational in India. So it made interactions with those groups easier.
So in your thesis, one of the people that you talk about from this sort of elite background is a hotel owner who took you on a bike ride. Could you just tell us that story?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's very closely related to this whole idea of positionality. So one day that I was talking to the oldest hotelier in the region, actually, and he kind of took me on a bike ride on this super fancy bike. And as we were going through the village, people started coming out of their houses and they started saying, like, "Hail the king" to him in Bundeli. And I found that bizarre. It seemed like something out of, 1950s Bollywood film where these landed elites would go about and then people would kowtow to them. But it was kind of shocking that that context was still so live.
And so the fact that he occupied this position in society was a direct result of him and his control over the tourism trade in the area.
Yes. But
I think, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
And I think this particular character reflects the importance of the neoliberal conservation paradigm that's been central to tiger conservation in the context you studied. Could you tell us more? What is neoliberal conservation? What are the promises it makes? And what are its core tenets?
If I have to say it in one sentence, it is selling nature to save it, which is, very simply put, the idea that in order to conserve nature, you have to commodify it so that there exists some sort of incentive for people to save it. And that is ecotourism. What we see in Panna is really fascinating that way, because the tiger population went down to zero. The state physically brought in more tigers to increase the tiger population. And now what you see sold in tourism is this pristine forest that is untouched by humans, which is a colonial imaginary, and that is sold as a commodity in tourism.
And commodification, we talked about in our last episode with Mary. Check it out if you haven't. Commodification is the process of cutting up nature into distinct units, which can then be sold and consumed.
Absolutely. And this brings me to something else that I discuss in my thesis, which is this whole idea of selling nature to save it. not only does it promise to save nature, but it also promises economic development for the communities around it. And then what is more is that it promises to sensitize consumers to the cause of saving nature. So it's sort of seen as this win-win promise. Another favorite quote of mine from a scholar is, "You can have your conservation cake and eat development dessert too." But of course, this is deeply contestable.
Just to put the tiger within this picture of neoliberal conservation, one of the concepts that I think is so interesting in your thesis is the term of the cosmopolitan tiger. Could you just explain what that is?
So the imagination around the tiger has evolved a lot over time, and it was seen as this fierce beast that needed to be tamed, to now an animal that is fierce yet fragile and in need of saving. This is where I find the idea of the cosmopolitan tiger very interesting, because it is really images of tigers that have percolated deep into quotidian life in a way that, you know, the tiger can be consumed sitting in your home, watching TV, sitting in a safari gypsy. And when you're sitting in the safari gypsy, it's like you're consuming the tiger, but you're also saving it as a tourist. And so what we have with these images that are so present in quotidian and everyday life is they're not just representative of tourism, of tigers, or of the forest, but they actually mediate this whole landscape of conservation and consumption. If it weren't for these images in popular media, we wouldn't have these strong associations with what a tiger looks like in pristine nature, in need of saving. And what this entire exercise does is to obfuscate the human elements. So on the one hand, you have the tiger in pristine nature, and then on the other hand, you have this forest that is without humans.
So to sum up with a quote from the thesis, tiger tourism attempts to fix the image of a wild, fierce, yet easily consumable, ubiquitously present tiger to allow for its commodification.
And what you describe in your thesis is that the tourists coming to the area do not only come to consume the tiger, but they also seek, and I think that's central to the concept of ecotourism, they also seek some kind of authenticity. Could you elaborate on that?
So this idea of authenticity is central to tourism, because what it's doing is, with nature, it wants to produce pristine nature that can be consumed. And then what we see in homestays. So homestays are these low-cost, affordable enterprises that are run by villagers. It's an extension in someone's house, a room that you can rent. So what we see in homestays then is the drive to conserve tradition in its pristine form. So you have pristine nature and you have pristine tradition. And of course, this is laden with all kinds of tensions.
So when we're talking about these homestays, physically, what do they look like?
So I think the physical appearance of it itself is actually very telling and also very important to the conversation. Basically, the idea is to manufacture some version of rurality that, you know, appears really rural. For instance, I encountered this incident on the field where one of these homestays was being constructed, and there was a team from the government which went like, "Oh, you have a plastic door in your bathroom." And that's really common across a lot of village houses because it's utilitarian. But it didn't look rural enough. And so they were asked to replace that, or like they were told to stick some bamboo on top of it so that it looks rustic. So it's through architecture, through providing local food, that homestays are supposed to maintain this idea of an authentic rural life.
And are there limits to this authenticity?
Absolutely, because it is just one manufactured idea of what authentic village life looks like, and it caters to bourgeois and urban sensibilities. They have all kinds of, you know, comforts like Western toilets and so on inside homestays. These are not traditionally rural elements.
But so in both cases, we see some kind of spectacle that's fabricated for the tourists, and one of them is fabricating this nature with the tiger being an essential kind of symbol of the wilderness and the nature. And then on the other hand, you have this fabricated, maybe idealized version of like the authentic rural life, right, that people are also seeking. And so we see that both nature and tradition are reinvented. Can you elaborate on what the impacts of that reinvention is?
So I think the question that I found myself asking at some point was that, of course, you know, the idea of nature is changing, the idea, or rather being reinvented, and the same goes for tradition. And so what? But I think what is really a subtle hidden effect of this process of commodification and reinvention is how it alters rural identity itself, which is often made up of these really marginalized groups. And this sort of idea, the spectacularization of rural life, actually obfuscates all of the fraught realities that rural life is actually made up of. And then it dilutes the way people identify and often resist oppressive structures.
I think one of the things that you say in your thesis is that you can connect these notions of reinvented tradition with the current political climate in India. Could you just unpack that a little bit?
Yeah. So by no means do I want to draw a causal relationship between these two things, because I think that's, I don't think that one can argue that. But at the same time, what one can see is that the reinvention of tradition in these homestays is very resonant with the way that the right wing is going about sort of projecting Hindutva and Hindu nationalism. India, constitutionally, it's secular, cosmopolitan. It has a lot of different religions and cultures and so on. And the right wing is trying to pin it all into some version of traditional Hindu life, and also bring in all of these marginalized groups into the folds of Hinduism. So they're trying to do this with Adivasis. I think that in some ways, this whole impetus to go back to traditional, pristine, traditional rural life is kind of resonant with this right-wing project of Hinduizing India.
So I think this leads us really nicely on to maybe what you found as the limits of this win-win promise. So when we're looking at the reality of the life that these homestay owners and these guides are living under neoliberal conservation, does it live up to the promise?
Actually, and this is kind of going back to the quote from the thesis that you read out right in the introduction. I think what I found was that this promise was actually quite deceptive. This is really the crux of what I'm trying to argue. And this is invisible at first. In fact, it really started being visible to me only when I had some distance. But when I came back from the field, I really started asking myself exactly what about this is not working. Undoubtedly, and I want to say this, tourism does provide some avenues of earning and also often an escape from even more precarious forms of work. But that doesn't at the same time mean that tourism itself doesn't create precarious working conditions. So, and I saw this particularly in the cases of guides and homestay owners. Guides on the one hand face this pressure of being in an organized but an informal economy, so no job security, no health insurance, no employment guarantee, and flexible working hours. So they all kind of had to compete with each other to make a place for themselves. This is classic neoliberalism at work, where the onus of success is entirely on the individual, who is also navigating a very oppressive system to begin with. In the case of homestays, again, you see this. They often have to pick up big loans in order to build these homes. Women face a double burden of commodified gender roles and also keeping up with their housework in the beginning. So there is this illusory promise of, like, it's not just an economic promise, it's also an emancipatory promise. But that promise doesn't actually hold up. It doesn't work for everyone. And the people that I most likely spoke to in this short span were people who were sort of somehow making it work. And then there are hundreds of other people who don't actually get included in this endeavor at all because there are barriers to entry. So
who wins?
So on the one hand, you have all of these people who kind of have to fight a lot of social barriers to win. And then on the other hand, I observed that there were people who already had a lot of class and caste privilege, like hoteliers, who were really benefiting from this project. They already had land, or in cases where they didn't have land, they had the social and economic might to be able to buy land and to start their tourism business. And they also have that sort of, they have that clout in the village and in society to actually be able to maintain their hierarchies. And a lot of villagers who are often displaced then get employed as tourism labor within, say, these resorts for really low salaries.
So we've talked about the win-win for humans. What about the nature?
Well, some would argue that because the tiger numbers have risen, it is a win for nature because, you know, the tiger is the apex predator, and a healthy tiger population indicates a healthy food chain and so on. But this is a very narrow epistemological framework, actually, of looking at what a conserved or a biodiverse forest looks like. I'm not an expert on this, but certainly I can say that that's also something that needs to be questioned.
So I think when we look at the flaws of the win-win promise, we can really relate it back to the neoliberal part of neoliberal conservation, because one of the things that you emphasize throughout your portrayal of neoliberalism is that it forces the focus on the individual. It forces, it views success as an individual endeavor, and it also puts the full weight of negative consequences on the individual. And then what we see is, if you can only view the world in units of one, then you can't look at societies and you can't look at hierarchies. And then this focus on neoliberalism and on the individual means that these hierarchical societies remain in place without the kind of language to deconstruct them.
Absolutely. I think this is the other effect of this, is by putting all the onus on the individual of success and failure, it completely weakens social organization. And India has had a rich history of mobilization against caste oppression, against gender-based oppression, and so on. And this is what I found on the field, was something as significant as the Forest Rights Act, which is being adopted in other parts of the country, found no mention in Panna. And I don't think that it's unrelated to the way that people are being coerced into this economy.
Amazing. Thank you so, so much, Satya, for coming and speaking to us about this really fascinating topic.
If you'd like to know more about Satya's thesis, or you'd like to give it a read, which I really do recommend, then we're going to leave Satya's LinkedIn in the bio, and you can contact her, and I'm sure she'll be more than pleased to talk to you like she's talked to us. So thank you very much for coming along.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. This was great fun.
Okay. Good.